All right, we're talking to Tim Tyler, who used to work at Wacky back in the 60s, I know. Tim, when exactly were you at Wacky?
I went there in 1963 and was there till 1973. I was on the air 5.5 years, and then I was in sales. I saw the sales guys driving nicer cars, little transition in life, and I thought, well, I'll just try this sales thing. And I found out I was pretty good at it and eventually moved into management, and now just a little bit of ownership.
Now, tell me how you came to Wacky. Where were you before then?
I was working in Peoria, Illinois at WIRL. It was kind of a hot radio station in Peoria, if anything's really hot in Peoria. I moved there because I had family there. I had had a call. It was owned by Lynn Broadcasting at that time. I had had several calls from Lynn, and I'm not really sure how they knew about me, other than a guy from Mike McCormick, who ended up at WIFE in Indianapolis. He called me and wanted me to go to KAAY in Little Rock, Arkansas. I couldn't get excited about going to Little Rock, and the timing wasn't right. I'd only been in Peoria just a few months. Then he called me about going to WMAK in Nashville, and that never did come together. And then he called me about Wacky in Louisville. And I wasn't really aware of how big a radio station it was. I was making $110 a week in Peoria, Illinois. I'd only been there 6 months, and I'd had these three calls from Mike McCormick. I thought, well, hey, I'm not sure I really want to go, but they were offering me a big $125 a week.
Wow.
You know, $15 a week more, you know. Hey, I was 21 years old and running around the country trying to be a disc jockey, trying to get to WABC in New York. So I went and told the manager. I said, well, hey, I've got this job offer in Louisville. And I was thinking, yeah, we'll match the offer. And so I was just going to stay there in Peoria. And so as I mentioned that, and he says, well, I think you'll like Louisville. So that's how I got to Louisville, and it was a great experience. I was doing afternoon drive in Peoria, and I ended 7 to midnight. Or was it midday? It was either 7 to midnight or middays. I can't even remember. It's been so long ago.
Now, the air check that we've heard you on the site from 1966, I believe, you were one happening nighttime disc jockey.
I spent most of my time 7 to midnight. I did middays. I did mornings. We had one of the original team shows. It was Tim and Jim, or he may say Jim and Tim, but Jim Brand and I did a morning show as a team for a brief time. I never did afternoon drive, and I never did all nights at Wacky, but I did mornings, middays, and evenings.
Do you remember who the staff was when you came to Wacky in 1963?
Jack Sanders was afternoon drive, who was really a legend in that city. Had been there for a number of years, had a great number of connections to the music world. Farrell Smith was doing middays. He had worked at WABC in New York, and he was a full-blooded Indian doing mornings at that. When I first came there, who was doing mornings? We turned over morning men quite often. I think Jim Brand was actually doing mornings at that particular time.
Was he the program director who hired you?
Actually, I was hired by the general manager, which I always thought was kind of strange. A guy by the name of Joel Thrope. All of the correspondence was with him. Maybe that was just a sign of the times. Hey, I was 21 years old. I didn't know. It was $125 a week. You know, that's all the money in the world.
Exactly.
And $75 for dances every weekend. And in the 60s, we made as much money on the outside doing personal appearances. And then I later got into concert promotion while I was a DJ also. You could make $50, $75 a night working two or three nights, because music was a very, very big part of the radio station and of the Louisville culture in the 60s that carried on to the 70s. And there's still elements of that still visible in Louisville today.
You mentioned Jack Sanders. What was Jack Sanders like from working with him as a fellow disc jockey?
Oh, he was a charismatic individual. His morals, his lifestyle was 100% opposite of mine. He would probably be called today a compulsive, obsessive personality. He was kind of like our leader. He would come into the control room with a cup of coffee, or he would come in with a coffee cup that had a vodka martini. He'd get in there about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. the days that he would get there early, we would go to lunch and we'd play pool for 2 hours or 3 hours. We would get on these kicks. He got us all on a bowling team. Just whatever he was into at the time, he had us all into it. And he had such a connection to the music field in Nashville. He needed a little extra money. He'd produce a record. He was tight with a guy by the name of Shelby Singleton, who was a big Nashville A&R guy at the time, primarily with Mercury, but I don't think he was limited to one label. Some of that, his connection was, he was the founder of the major music company in Louisville. It was called the Sambo Agency. And if you can imagine, the name Sambo at one point in time became a bit of an issue. But this was the early 60s, and the Sambo really standed for Sanders. It was Jack Sanders, Ray Allen, and Hardy Martin. So it was S-A-M-B-O for booking, Sambo Booking Agency. And they had all these hot bands, the Carnations and the Trendells, the Sultans, Cosmo and the Counts, and a variety of other ones. Music was just a big, big part of it, and they had a music studio. Jack Sanders left and ended up going to Nashville, and I actually bought out his share of Sambo. And so it became Schwartz, Allen, and Martin, with Don Schwartz being my real name. And then the unpopularity of the name Sambo, if you remember, there was, and it may even be Denny's today, but there was a food chain called Little Black Sambo's Restaurants. And, of course, they changed their name in the 60s, too. And we became Triangle Talent, which still exists today. I sold my interest later down the road. But there was a very strong integration with the music business and the radio station, not in a payola way. There was live music. As a teenager, you could go to six different places on any Friday or Saturday night and hear live music. I remember Dusty Springfield made her first appearance in Louisville, Kentucky, wow, at a Fraternal Order of Police dance that was sponsored by, I think they put it on and the DJs were there, and she had never performed in public in the United States, and the band knew her song, and she sang her one hit at that time because she only had one hit, and she wasn't really a big star, but that was through a Shelby Singleton connection, that, and she was touring. But we were just integrated with the music industry.
Let's talk about Jack Sanders leaving. Elsewhere on the website is the story of why Jack left. But from your perspective as a fellow DJ, do you remember when that happened and what that was all about? And you, as a coworker with Jack, did you get a chance to talk with him about the situation as he was leaving or after he left?
Yes. In fact, I kept in touch with Jack through the years, and I never had it confirmed, but either the day he died or the day before he died, he called me, and he ended the phone very abruptly. Then actually, a few weeks later, I learned that he had actually died. So we had loose contact. We didn't talk every week. We talked occasionally. Jack lived an entirely different lifestyle. He got involved in a situation that there was elements of truth to. All the charges were ended up dismissed, and he ended up leaving and ended up going to Nashville, and everything was cool.
They terminated him, though, immediately, though, after hearing those charges, right?
Yes, they did. I can't remember the exact time. They stuck with him for a little while because the individual that was involved, there was some problems on the other side, too. So, you know, there's always two sides to every story.
I bet you Jack wasn't too happy about leaving Wacky.
No, he wasn't. He had been there a long time. I mean, he was king. I mean, he could do anything he want. I mean, he was one of the DJs at that time. And, you know, hey, he came and went as he desired to a certain extent, you know. He's great with production, and he was just a total radio guy. But he lived a wild, wild life. He did have a lot of connections in Nashville, so it was a somewhat easy transition for him to go to Nashville because of all of the music connections. And then he went on to be, you know, Hank Williams Jr. as a road manager and involved in the music industry there and in the ad agency business. And he was very, very talented.
So it could have been a cool thing for him to leave Louisville, you know, because evidently he did well after he left and went to Nashville.
Yes, I think you're exactly right. He probably benefited and came out ahead. And his talent probably warranted that. However, parts of his lifestyle probably caught up with him.
So what was a typical Tim Tyler show like? Let's concentrate on you doing the nights, because I think that's what you're most remembered for, was doing the night show at Wacky. What was it like being a disc jockey back in those times before computers and everything was played off records and carts, and Wacky was the big radio station in town with a teenage audience? What was that like being on the air and doing that?
It was just total fun. I mean, you really, to a certain extent, you live the lifestyle. You're very involved with the audience. Phones were very, very important. Talking to listeners on the air. We did a lot of cut up, a lot of screaming, a lot of yelling, the music. We did the name it and claim it and pick the songs and all the things that we look back at and to a certain extent make fun of. But, you know, they're still going on today with just different names and different faces. There was a lot of involvement with the listener and interaction in the listeners. You could actually play requests. This was before computerized playlists. And you actually had some freedoms in the music you played. You could play some stuff that was not on the actual playlist. And you were playing the 45s, wearing them out. And we'd have guests in the studio occasionally. One of the memories I have of people calling, because, I mean, you always answered the phone. It was just an important part of it, and you were coached to do that. But somebody who used to call and make requests, Cassius Clay.
Wow.
Today known as Muhammad Ali. That's one of my wacky stories. This goes back into very early in Cassius Clay's career. Cassius Clay was a very good friend of our maintenance guy at the radio station. And Cassius had won one of his important fights, the syndicate in Louisville that put him together first, headed by a guy by the name of William H. King, to reward him for winning this fight and moving up in his career, bought him a tomato red Cadillac convertible. Well, he brought it by the radio station. This is when we were in the old Kentucky Home Life building. So this is early 60s. Jamie was his friend's name, and he came to show Jamie the car. And of course, we all went down and looked at this red Cadillac convertible, just ooh, ah. And so as a result of that, he used to come to the radio station occasionally. You know, he put out a couple of records on Columbia Records. He only maybe called 2, 3, 4 times. But he did call and make a request because he had some people over at his house. And then another time I remember him calling, and he had a new single out. I can't remember the name of it. It was on Columbia Records. And he had people at his house, and he wanted them to hear it on the radio. And so we played it for him.
What was the highlight of your time at Wacky on the air?
I don't know of a specific instance. It was really just the times. The music that we played then continues to be around. And I think that says something for the times itself. I was involved a lot with the music industry myself, particularly with the Sambo, which became Triangle Talent Agency, and artists and promotions and concerts. We had a lot of artists that would come through. Paul Revere and the Raiders coming in and basically taking over the afternoon show or the early evening show. I was on 6 to 9 at one point in time. That was always a lot of fun.
Tell us about the Beach Boys. I know you promoted at least one Beach Boys concert in Louisville.
I actually did three. By then, I was a big 23 years old. In addition to all these music events that were going on, I put on my own little dance over in Jeffersonville, Indiana, called the Ewing Lane Dance. We'd have the Sultans, Cosmo, and the Counts, and all the local hot artists. But then we started getting some of the other artists because they were actually affordable. Someone had told me that you could get the Beach Boys for $950 because they had played in Cincinnati at Le Swordsville Lake. And so I called the booking agent, William Morris Agency in Chicago, and they said, no, they're not $950 anymore. At this time, I Get Around was just out, and they'd had a couple of milder hits. And this is 1964. He said, they're $3,500. And he said, but they also come with the Kingsmen, and they come with Freddie Cannon and another artist who I don't remember. It's $3,500. Well, I'd saved up my first $1,000. Hey, I was 23 years old. $1,000, I had it in my pocket. And they said, well, we can book this date for you, and we'd love to come to Louisville. They're going to Lincoln, Nebraska. Then they're on their way to Indianapolis, and stopping in Louisville would be a great thing. I went to the other other disc jockeys and said, hey, I can get these guys for $3,500. I've got $1,000. I've talked to the Kentucky Fair and Exhibition Center, and they want $1,000. I was going to use the baseball stadium because it was cheaper than the arena. And then I needed $100 for the newspaper. Anyway, whatever the numbers add up to, I needed $1,950. That still gave me 51, 52, 53%. So anyway, with $1,950, we put this concert on, and I went and had a guy print me up 2,500 tickets, $2 a piece to see the Beach Boys.
Wow.
$250 at the door. Tickets are on sale, ran the $100 newspaper ad. We sold all 2,500 tickets. So I went and had another 2,500 tickets printed up, sold them. Had another 25. We ended up having 11,000 people
wow.
to see the Beach Boys in July of 1964. And of course, I always kept thinking, if I'd have just charged $1 more. and of course, in reality, they got more than $3,500 because they did 50% of the gate. But I did have, I cleared enough for me the next day that I went out and bought a new Thunderbird.
But good for
you. That's when Thunderbirds meant something in the 60s, the late 50s and early 60s. That was actually a pretty neat car. And then the next day, I went and booked the Four Seasons, and we had the Four Seasons and a laundry list of artists like Ruby and the Romantics and Bobby Goldsboro and the Chiffons and, I don't know, several other artists. And we had 8,000 people for that. And then I did have the Beach Boys again in December. By then, most of my partners, they thought I was crazy, but we still had about 8,000 people for them. And Brian Wilson was at that first concert. The substitute Beach Boy for the winter concert was Glenn Campbell.
Well,
a lot of people don't remember. I kind of felt sorry for Glenn Campbell. I've spent a little time with him because everybody's paying attention to the Beach Boys, and they didn't know who Glenn Campbell was. I mean, he was a studio musician at the time, and I knew who he was because he played on a lot of hit records, and he actually had one or two records out himself, but was never a hit. And then I had the Beach Boys again the following summer, and by then, Bruce Johnson was playing the role of Brian Wilson.
Which did you enjoy more, the concert promotion and the dances and stuff, or the radio gig being on the air?
It'd be a toss-up. One fed the other, and you enjoyed them for different reasons. I did enjoy the entrepreneur part of the concerts and went on to do concerts with the Association and Sonny and Cher and Ike and Tina Turner. Those groups actually sang together at one time. But one played into the other, and I enjoyed both of them. Although I think at some point in the time, obviously, at 27 years of age, I did think that I saw the business side of the thing going forth, and I became a little bit bored, perhaps, with the DJ part and went into sales. That became an opportunity to get into management, which you can kind of run the show. And I think I had a fairly successful run as a general manager, still doing it today. But I think being on the air gave me one-upsmanship in our business.